My name is Hilda Hearn, and I am from Smithfield, Virginia, and I'm a recovering Al-Anon.
Hi.
Hi. This is kind of awesome. I really was not expecting, but just a very few, because, you know, most drunks cut and run when Al-Anon talks. But you all look so good. You look like a group of sobering drunks and serene Al-Anons. You look like sober drunks should. Thank you for being here. I'm a little nervous, but lest I forget, I want to thank the committee or whoever responsible for us being here. It's been great up until this point. So we'll see. The accommodations are beautiful, and the fruit basket is wonderful, and your hospitality has been so good, and we just want to thank you for it. I want to thank you for it. What he does is up to him. I do want you all to meet my reason for being. Tommy, would you stand? That's the him that made me suffer so. He's in that bright sweater. I want to tell you a little story about Tommy. When he was drinking, he wore dark clothes. He had dark suits and dark ties and always real drab. And I figured whatever happened to him that day, he was dressed for it. Well, now he gets up, and I never know whether he's going to look like the candy man or ice cream cone. But that's been kind of neat to watch that evolve. I am a little nervous, but I'm going to settle down in a few minutes, and I will be grateful for having had this opportunity. I never feel qualified or capable, but I was told originally that I didn't have to be. All I had to do was be willing, and I've tried to be that. But in order for me to calm down a little bit, I'm going to tell you an Al-Anon story. Now, if you have heard it, just giggle. But if you haven't, laugh like hell and make me feel better. There was this couple, Charlie and Mabel, and Charlie was a drunk. Mabel had a cat that she loved. And apparently Charlie was a cat abuser, because every time he would get drunk, he'd abuse Mabel's cat. And he came in very drunk one afternoon, and the cat crossed his path, and he just put his foot right in that cat's side, and it flipped over and came down, and Mabel reached over and picked the cat up, and she started rubbing him. And she says, "That's okay, kitty. If Charlie continues to drink, he's going to die soon. And when he does, I'm going to have him cremated, and I'm going to sprinkle his ashes in your litter box." Sounds like revenge to me. And when I got to you people, that's what I wanted, revenge. Revenge. I'm going to try to share with you in the next few minutes something about this family disease. Libba talked about it Thursday night, and Bob talked about it yesterday morning, and then Christy alluded to it last night. The story I'm going to tell you, I hope, is a story of hope, because when I came to you people, I had no hope. If there was one word that I could use to describe me pre-Al-Anon, that word would have been discontented. I was never happy at any point in my life. If it was Saturday, I wished it was Monday. If it was winter, I wanted summer to come. And if it was night, I wished it was day. It was going to always be better at some other time or when something else happened. That's changed for me today, and I'm very grateful for that. I depended on other people to make me happy. And when I wasn't happy, it was someone else's fault. I blamed all the rotten things that happened to me on my lousy husband and four rotten kids. It was their fault. It could not have been my fault. I was brought up in... I want to tell you this first. So many of you alcoholics get up here and say, you haven't found it necessary to have a drink since 1900. Well, I have not found it necessary to have an insanity attack since 1972. That is not to say I haven't had them. They just weren't necessary. You relate to that too. But I was brought up in a good home. I used to say I was brought up in a Christian home, but so many alcoholics say that it sounds like a breeding ground for alcoholism. But I was brought up in a good home. I felt loved and protected. I had a puritanical mother, but I had a very loving father. He's the first person that I knew anything about that practiced unconditional love. And I didn't know that's what you called it, but he just loved with an open hand and complete acceptance of other people. And I always felt love from my dad. I was okay. And he always told me that. But with my mother, I never felt that I measured up. I never was quite good enough. That bothered me, and I struggled to get her approval, and it never happened. But through this program, I have put that to rest and made peace with it. And it only happened a few years ago. I know today my mother was unable to show me and to give to me what I thought I needed. You see, she too was brought up in an alcoholic home. Her mother died when she was a little child, and her father was alcoholic and raised her. And she never knew how to show love. And she was never able to share that with me, which saddens me, because she never found any help for that soul sickness that alcoholism brings about. I've had to do a lot of soul searching in order to find this peace. And the way I did it was I asked that God let me see my mom as he saw her. And when I was able to do that, I understood and the peace came. The pain is no longer there. Thinking about it brings up some pain. But I know my mom loved me as much as she was capable of. And because I learned about unconditional love in this room, I found out that my mom knitted sweaters for me. She would sew into the night for me. She did all those things that I couldn't see were signs of love. But thank God I've taken care of that. But I guess I was a good kid. I was told things you don't do, did the things I was told to do, and life was fairly simple, except where I complicated it. Now, I went with Tom for a long, long time. Met him when I was a mere child. And he went off to fight for our country. And I stayed home and entertained the troops. And you can guess who had the best time. But when he came back, we did get married. And I'd like to tell you that we went together 4 years and still married. So I don't know what that says for his sanity or mine. I jokingly said to Tom the other day, we've been married 46 years. That's right. And I told him, I said, you know, you are my first husband, but if you don't straighten out, you might not be my last. So, but when Tom married, I wanted to be the best wife he could have. You see, part of my sickness was trying to be the best. I thought if I could just be good, people that I loved would love me back. But I started off trying to please. I wanted to be whatever he wanted his wife to be. Now, in my fantasy, I had this marriage all mapped out. You know, we were going to marry, and we were going to get a little house in the country with a picket fence and have a dog named Spot. And we would have two daughters and two sons, and we'd go to church and to PTA, and we'd see our children married, and we'd grow old, and we'd have grandchildren, and die. Now, in my head, I have that completely mapped out. I want you to know that's not an inkling of what my life has been. But that was my fantasy. And Tom was very ambitious, and he worked hard, and I stayed home, and I started having sons. Now, we have four. We didn't stay mad all the time. We'd make up about every 3 years, and we'd have another son. But as they came along, I wanted to be the best mother that they could have. And I struggled and tried very hard. I just got into doing what I thought normal families did, and that was be a part of the children's lives, go to church, get involved, and be a helpmate to my husband. I didn't know Tom drank at all. Now that sounds weird, having gone with him for 4 years, but I never saw him drink. He was away most of the time, and it just wasn't a problem. And once he came home, and we went out a little, we went to dances once in a while, and I thought they were for dancing, and I guess he thought they were for drinking, because that's what he did. Now, I wasn't worried about it. About 10 o'clock, he got kind of cute, and it was okay. Later became very obnoxious. But early on, it was okay, and I certainly wasn't worried about it. There had never been any alcohol. I don't know that there was any alcohol in my home. I don't ever remember it. But certainly no drinking. So I was never exposed to it. Now, the type of drinking that I did, Tom says, was sickening. I'd go to a dance and put a thimble full of booze, and I'd fill it up with whatever, Coke or whatever, and I'd put an orange, a banana, and a Christmas tree on top. And Tommy says, that's sickening drinking, and I'd sip on that all night. But I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I knew what a drunk was. There was a guy on the long coat on the corner that didn't work. My husband could not have been that, I didn't think. But we just became very busy and involved. And I certainly wasn't worried about alcoholism. But things began to happen in our home. And I became very afraid. I began to find bottles in the bushes and in the closets, and you know the places. And that frightened me. And I would ask Tommy about them, and he would say, oh, that's been there forever. Or I'd say, you know, you drank too much last night. He said, that's your imagination. And he convinced me. And I thought, well, you know, just let go and see what happens. And I tried. And things got worse and worse. Now, I know our kids were aware of what was going on. And I want you to know right now that I did more damage to my sons than Tom ever did with his drinking. You see, Tom just passed out. He didn't cause any problems, but I was the one that went absolutely insane when he'd pass out at night. The kids would come in the house and look at me as if to say, "What is wrong with you?" And I could not tell them. If I did anything right in those days, it was I never condemned their dad. And I'm glad I didn't, not through words anyway. Because when he was able to love them, their love was still there for him. But Tom would pass out, and he wouldn't go to bed. God forbid that he'd go to bed. But he would pass out in the den, and it was in the recliner, with his hands folded on his chest, and he looked so peaceful. Or he'd pass out on the couch, and he was totally at ease, and I was insane. Now, I know the kids knew what was going on, but I'd say, "Your dad's tired. He's had a hard day." And when they left the room, I'd kick the hell out of their sick and tired daddy. Now, I am not proud of that. But that was my insanity. I could not stand to see this man at peace. So that was the only way that I could get revenge. And I used that lots of times. He had a right hard time with his ribs. But as the disease progressed, I began to withdraw. And it was at this time that our second son became very ill. He had encephalitis, sleeping sickness. And just as his memory was returning, he was hit by an automobile. And where I had been full of fear about Tom and his drinking, I became obsessed about Craig. What was going to happen? Was he going to live? Was he going to be a vegetable? And this was in my mind, the squirrel cage 24 hours a day. When Tom was going to drink, how much he was going to drink, was he going to jail, was he going to lose his jobs, and then with Craig's illness, was he going to live? And I got sicker and sicker. My dad was a very important person in my life, and he is part of my story. Because he was such a big part of my life, I knew that I wouldn't talk about Tom drinking. God forbid that I let anybody know. You know, I had to keep this facade and pretend that we were that Campbell soup family that looked so good on the outside. And for a long time, I was able to keep that up. I'd put the smile on my face, and I'd dress my kids, or they'd dress themselves, and off we'd go to church. And I would sit there dying on the inside with a smile on my face. But as my disease progressed, it became harder and harder to smile. And that's when I began to live behind my walls. But I knew somehow that as long as my dad was alive, that the kids and I'd be okay. I didn't know how, but we'd be okay. I had to take Craig, that's the son that was so sick, to the medical college in Richmond. And felt so very alone. I can still feel that pain now. But when we came home, my dad was taken ill and died within 9 days, and my world fell apart. And whereas I had functioned, I ceased to function. My sofa became my haven, both day and night. When I tell people that I am glad to be here sane and in my right mind, I really mean that, because it hasn't always been that way. But life just got more complicated and more complicated. And where I had functioned, I ceased to function. And I did have to seek professional help. Now, when I got to the psychiatrist, there was absolutely no way I was going to tell him anything about him. Now, I had been to an uncle, Tom's uncle, that didn't know he drank at all, and he told me I was crazy. And I went to a friend who knew Tom drank socially. And he said, "Oh, Hilda, don't exaggerate. Just sit down and have one with him." So I figured if these two people didn't believe me, no one would. So I swore I would not tell anybody else. So when I got to the psychiatrist, he looked at me and I stared at the floor. And he wanted to know who these people were that had done this to me. And I said, I didn't know what he was talking about. The only thing I would discuss was my dad. And that went on for a long time. I did get better, and we were asked to take a transfer. And Tom said he drank because of me, and I assumed that was true. But I was better. And he drank because of Craig, and Craig was getting better. And he drank because of his job. So, you know, I rationalized that if we left Suffolk and the home office, he wouldn't need to drink anymore. And that certainly made a lot of sense to me. So off we went to the mountains of Virginia. And you know, we carried our sick selves with us. And the disease just progressed. I'm not going into the next few years. They were very bad years, not only for me, but very bad for Tom, and certainly tragic for our four sons. I'd like to tell you that I have one son, this morning we have. That's kind of a joke because when we have four sons, but when Tom's out of sorts with one, that one becomes mine. Well, this morning we have four sons. And one's 45, and one's 41, and 37, and 33. So they are 4 years apart. That's what I was talking about. But we are very proud of them. They all have their scars because they were brought up in an alcoholic home. But I know those next 2 years were terrible, terrible times for us. I'll tell you, I know what the mental institutions are like. I've been there. I know what shock treatments are. I've had those. And I know what fear beyond description is. I've been there. Fear went to bed with me at night and woke with me in the morning. If I was outside, I was afraid to go in. And if I was inside, I was afraid to go out. At that time, I felt that I could not continue living. I didn't think I could do anything to me physically. But I would ride around Christiansburg, looking for a mountain and thinking one day I'll have the courage and I'll just check out. Obviously, that's not what happened. But I felt that was my only out because I had no hope. I had no hope for Tom, and I had no hope for me or my family. We left Christiansburg and went to Richmond, and it was here I found Al-Anon. And I would like to tell you what that was like afterwards. I'm sure the part I've already told you is very much like what you experienced in your home, only different situations. But what it's like, what happened, was I got better. I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. A friend of mine came to my home uninvited because I had ceased inviting people. But she saw a little bit about what was happening, and she wrote to me and said, "Run, don't walk, to the nearest Al-Anon family group." And I thought, oh, well, why not? You know, I had promised her I'd do that. So I called the answering service, and there's a gal named Jenny. that was my contact, and I'll always love her. I didn't talk to her, but it was just as if she were looking in my windows, and I knew she knew. At last, somebody knew what was going on, and she didn't tell me I exaggerated or that it was my fault. She told me the time and place of the next meeting, of the first meeting, and I was there. I walked into a church on a Wednesday morning and heard people laughing and talking, and I immediately assumed I was in the wrong place because I had not laughed and made small talk in a long, long time. But knowing I was new, they welcomed me. And as we started the meeting or whatever they were doing, they asked me if I had any questions, and you know what I asked them? How I could get my husband sober. You also know what they told me. I couldn't. But with that negative thing, they gave me something positive, and that was I could get better. That regardless of what happened to him, I could get better, and that's exactly what I needed to hear. I had felt very responsible for the drinking, because if I'd have been a better wife, he wouldn't have needed to drink. If I'd have been prettier, if I'd have been thinner, if I'd have been a better housekeeper, something other than what was going on, he wouldn't have needed to drink. So certainly it was my fault. And I also felt with my kids that if I'd have been a better mother, if home had been better, then they wouldn't be out there drinking and drugging and having their lives a mess too. But they told me that morning that I did not cause the illness in my home. First they told me he was sick, and I almost laughed because he was sick every morning, but I didn't know he couldn't help it. But they told me he had a disease, a compulsion beyond anything that I could imagine. And that opened up just my heart just a little bit. Once I was able to accept that, I could have some compassion for this man that I loved one minute and hated the next. But they told me I didn't cause it. They also told me I couldn't control it and I couldn't cure it. What a freedom. That relieved me of a lot of anxiety. You know, in my family, and I think in most alcoholic families, the blame is terrible. It's his fault. No, it's your fault. If you hadn't, I wouldn't. And my family was real good at that. But I started going to these meetings. I didn't know what I was doing. I just did what somebody told me to do. And they said, keep coming back. Well, in those days in Richmond, there were not too many Al-Anon meetings. Lots of them there now. But I went to the next meeting, which was on a Monday night, and that had been Wednesday. But I kept in touch with this gal, Jenny, that introduced me to Al-Anon. But I went to that meeting, couldn't wait for Monday night to come. Just knew that I was going to get the answers there, because this was a night group and they'd know a lot more than those housewives. So I went with lots of expectations, and what I saw was different faces, but it was the same atmosphere. They said the Serenity Prayer and they read what they call 12 steps. And I did not know what they were, but they sounded good. And the one I liked was number 12. Carry the message. And you know who I carried it to. You also know it didn't work. But I left that night with my ODAP book and a feeling that I belonged. I was with some people that were strange, but they had something that I didn't have. They encouraged me to take the focus off of my husband and put it on me and my family. And I tried to do that, and it was very difficult. But I had some success sometimes. And what happened was I began to get better. And as I got better, my sons reacted to me, and they began to get better. Home was more pleasant most of the time. Tom got worse, but we got better. And by this time, that was the only thing I was interested in, was my family, my sons and myself getting better. I started looking at the steps. I had some people that loved me and didn't even know me. They really practiced the principles of the Al-Anon program. Very grateful for them. But I looked at that step one and had absolutely no problem with it. Paralysis over alcohol, sure I was. I knew that. I was also powerless over the alcoholic, and I knew that. And certainly our family was sick. No one was in control. Step two for me, and I'm not going to take you through all the steps. Don't get scared. Step two for me was a little different, a little difficult. Now I'd like to tell you my concept of God. I'd always believed, but he was a big no-no in the sky. He was going to get me. He was out to get me. And it depended on what I said or did, how bad it would be. Church, Sunday school had always been a part of my life, but my mother was so rigid with her religion that I never knew about a loving God. And I'm not blaming that on her. It's just the church I attended did not talk about a loving God. And I just knew that he was going to zap me. So when I came into the Al-Anon program, and you talked about a close contact with God, you talked about a higher power, and I didn't know what all that was about. But I began to read and I began to share. And first I had to break that second step up. First I had to come. I had to come to meetings like this and others. And then I came to just a little bit. And then I came to believe. It isn't what I believe today, it's what I know. Because God is a very big part of my life today. And I didn't like the last part of that step. Restore me to sanity. Because of my past history in the mental institutions, I had a hard, tough time with that one. Sure, I'd done some insane things. I'd planned Tom's funeral, tried to decide on 8 pallbearers, never could come up with but 4. And I worried myself to death about what the preacher could say over this guy. And that's not sane thinking. But I just wanted to be prepared when the time came. But I had to take that second step and look at it. It didn't say I was crazy. It said my thinking was confused, distorted, and that I could accept. And the third step for me has not been one that I've been able to do once and let it go. I have to do this on a daily basis. I did it 15 minutes or 5 minutes before I walked in the store. I have to do that on a daily basis. You see, it's not my life. I don't have trouble turning my life over. It's my self-will that I have a difficult time letting go of. I could not imagine what the fourth step was all about. I had never known who Hilda was. I was Tom's wife, Sonny Craig, Mike Charles's mother, someone's sister, someone's daughter. I had never known anything about the person that I had become or was at that time. So I didn't know what to even attempt to do. So I hung in on a 3-step program for a long time. And someone said to me, "Now, Hilda, if you want to grow, you're going to have to go and do a 4th step." So what I did was took a very negative inventory.
I wanted to get rid of all those shoulds and shouldn'ts. And what happened, I got worse. I became much more negative than I had been. But a very loving, kind Al-Anon said, you go back, and every time you write something bad, you find something good. And it took a while, but I finally did it. And I took my fifth step with a tough doctor who had become my friend. And my dad used to tell me I was pitiful but perfect. And that felt pretty good for a martyr. But this doctor didn't tell me that. But what he said was, Hilda, you did the best you could with what you had to work with. And that I could accept. The hardest step that I've had to make has been to my sons, the amends. I had to go to Tom and let him know that I was sorry I had made it so easy for him to drink. Not that I caused him to drink, but that I was sorry I'd made it so easy for him to keep on drinking. I had to make some amends to myself, just to, in a way of being good to myself. And the way I did that was to pamper myself a little bit, take time for myself. Today, I'm pretty good to myself. Do a lot of things for Hilda. But it also helps everybody else because it makes me feel good. But the tough ones was to my sons. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my sons, our sons. We left home Thursday. And one of our sons has been very sick, but he had come back to work and wanted to tell us goodbye. That son is the same son that was so sick in his teen years. That's also the son that's the addict, one of them, and is recovering for 6 years in the NA program. But he came to say goodbye. Have fun. Do good, Mom. You know I love you. And that's very special to me. I feel like one day, because he needs to be in this fellowship too, that maybe one day he'll speak with his dad and myself. And I believe that's going to happen in God's time. But my third son has been most affected by this disease. My first son, I want to tell you, is an alcoholic. He doesn't know it because he doesn't drink. But he has all the isms there is to have. And I guess he just doesn't know he could get some relief if he drank. But nevertheless, and then I told you about my son Craig, who got big time into cocaine. And because of his wonderful wife, I had seen all the signs. I knew, you know, when we know that gut that tells us we know. But there was nothing concrete I could go to him with. Until she loved me enough and loved Craig enough to come to me. And what we did was intervened on this young man 6 years ago. And he's been clean since. Now his dad told me a while back, when Tom says, sit down, I need to talk to you. I know that's going to be a lecture or he's got something real rotten to say. So I sat down and my heart went in my throat. And he says, I think I need to let you know Craig's drinking. Well, I'll tell you, folks, my Al-Anon went out the window. I had had it, you know. We had gotten this kid straight. And now he's drinking. How dare he? But you see, it wasn't him that I was angry at. It was this damn disease that doesn't care about him It doesn't care about me. It doesn't care about any of us. And that was the anger that I was experiencing. But I had to go to Craig. And that's one of the things that the Al-Anon program has taught me, that I do need to share my feelings with other people. It's the way I do it that makes the difference. So I went to Craig and I shut his door to his office and told him I needed to talk with him. And when they all say, when something's wrong, I call a summit, and they all shake in their boots. But he said, "What is it, Mom?" And I said, "Craig, it's been brought to my attention you started drinking." He said, "Oh, Mom, that's no problem." I said, "You know, I'm not here to debate this with you. I just need to share the way I feel about it. And I don't need to argue at all. I just need to let you know that I love you, but I'm very concerned about you, because that alcohol will take you right back to that cocaine." Oh, he said, no, Mama, you know, drugs is not a choice. I know all that." And all I could do is just hug him and tell him I loved him. And I said, "What I see in you at 40 years old is exactly what I saw in your dad when he was 40. And it frightens me." And he said, "Oh, but that'll never happen to me. So what can you say, you know?" And I do a lot of praying for him. Excuse me. But my third son existed the only way he knew how to exist. He got involved in chemicals at a very young age. And he's done an awful lot of hurting. There came a time in Tom's and my marriage that I did have to make a decision to leave. I'd been in the program 2 years, and even with the program, it was almost too much to live with on a daily basis. And he'll tell you about that himself. But I had to leave, and our son Mike at that time was 18 years old. And he chose to stay with his dad. And he tried the best he could to feed him, to take care of him. But he stood there and watched his daddy dying. He had a lot of anger towards me because I chose to leave. Hopefully all that's taken care of today, although once in a while when Mike gets angry, he doesn't know how to express feelings, and it just burst out. But I had to go to Mike and make some special amends. And I had put it on hold for a long time. I just couldn't do it because I said he'd become emotional, he'd cry and I'd cry, and But when I pray about things happen. And it had been on my mind, and I'd been doing a lot of praying. So one evening Mike and I was left at the dinner table, and I asked him if he could stay and talk with me for a few minutes. And he wanted to know if it was necessary, and I said yes. So we talked for about 5 minutes, and he said, "Mom, that's enough. You must remember, I was a crazy, mixed-up kid too, and it's okay." Well, I thanked him for his time, but I wasn't finished saying what I needed to say. So I started writing, and I wrote 3 pages on a legal pad, and I took it upstairs and put it on his bed. And it happened that evening that I was up when Mike came in, said good night, and he came downstairs in just a few minutes, and he said, "Good night, Mom, I love you." And I knew it was done. At last, it was done. He's never mentioned that, and nor have I. He is married today, and on his second marriage. You'd have to see this guy to appreciate him. He's 6'2" and weighs about 235 pounds, and he's got a bushy beard, and so many miracles have happened in our family, and Tom will tell you some of those, but the one I'm going to tell you about is something that happened just not too long ago. We opened a new store. Now, our son Mike hasn't worn anything but blue jeans with holes in them and flannel shirts, and he's got a big bushy beard, and he wears his boots and his tennis shoes, and when he dresses up, he just puts a clean pair on, you know. So we were having the opening for the store, and I said to Mike, Mike said, "Mom, it's okay if I just wear a sweater." And I said, "No." And I said, "You're going to have to dress a little more." He said, "Well, you certainly don't think I'm going to buy a suit." And I said, "Well, that's up to you, but a sweater will not be appropriate." So I was able to let that go. I didn't call him the next day and ask him if he'd gone to get a coat. And that was progress for me. But he asked me, he called me and asked me if I'd go get him a sport coat, and I said yes, and so off I went. And of course, I didn't miss an opportunity. I not only bought the sport coat, I bought the pants and the shirt and the tie. And I took it home to this fella. Well, the sport coat was fine, but the pants had pleats in the front. And he looked at those pants and he said, "Mom, you don't really think I'm going to wear these pants, do you?" I said, "I don't know, Mike, but if you don't like them, you can take them back." Well, he came to that store that night with those pants, that coat, and shirt and tie. And I want you to know, he was just about the prettiest thing I ever saw. Mike doesn't have good self-esteem. But that night he was smiling, and he looked comparable to his brothers, and he felt good about himself. And he was just beautiful. But Mike chooses to be behind the scenes in the business. He likes to wear his jeans and his boots, and he doesn't want to be where the public is. And you know, today, that's okay. That is all right with me. Bothers Tom then and then when his hair gets too long, and they have a few days of hassling over when he's going to get a haircut. But I don't have to get in that anymore. That's not my problem anymore. And if Tom chooses to let that bother him, then that is his problems. But our Mike today is happy. The only thing that seemed to give him peace of mind, other than his drugs, was the woods, his hunting dogs, his guns. He could walk in the woods every night and come back with a degree of serenity that he didn't have when he left. And I'm very grateful for that. My youngest son is just wonderful. He is the only one of our sons that had the benefit of Alateen, and he's the most well-adjusted of the whole bunch. He's a neat guy. Our kids are so much alike, and yet they're so different. One walks around saying, "Ain't life awful?" Another one thinks it's a bowl of cherries. Then there's one that fluctuates back and forth. But I'm very grateful for these, and our youngest son is a really, really special young man. Very proud of him. I just want to tell you a few things that I learned in Al-Anon, and that was about living one day at a time. I had never lived a day at a time in my life. It was always regrets of the past, fear of the future, never just today. And I know today is all I have. And it's the way I live today that's going to make my tomorrow different. Yesterday's history and tomorrow's a mystery. And this is it. I'm awfully glad I learned about that. And I learned about love with no strings attached. That Tom didn't have to say, I love you. The kids don't have to say, I love you. Oh, it's nice to hear, but thank God I heard it in other ways. I enjoyed my dinner. You look good. I hear I love you, and I'm grateful for that. I do believe that the Al-Anon program saved my sanity. It saved our marriage. I also believe it has helped save my life. I'm very grateful today that I'm married to an alcoholic. Otherwise, I would have never known about a 12-step program that taught me about acceptance. A while back, I used that acceptance to help me with my own disease, which is cancer. Had it not been for that, I don't know how I would have handled it, or Tom either. But I'm very grateful to the fellowship of AA and for Al-Anon. You loved me. You prayed for me. You carried me when I couldn't do it for myself. But the greatest thing you gave to me was the encouragement to keep on keeping on. Thank you, God. I don't know what tomorrow holds for me, but then you don't either. I know that I talked to that doctor that told me about causing and curing the illness of alcoholism. I was reminded that I had a disease that I'm powerless of. I didn't cause it. I can't control it. And I can't cure it. My well-being is in someone else's hands. And I know what that means. You know, there's so many, many miracles that's transpired in our life, and I know I'm going a little over. You gave me a miracle this weekend, and that is Tom and I rode from Smithfield 7 hours in a car by ourselves and did not have an argument. Now, that's right. I don't know what going home is going to bring, but and it was great, and we didn't sit there and not talk. We talked, and it's great. But there are so many miracles, and the miracle of meeting you and the miracle of being here. I think this is times when Bill Wilson was talking about when you will be going places and doing things that you never thought possible. And who would have ever known that this would have happened to Tom and I, and I'm very grateful. You know, they say the experience and then the lesson, and I pray that Tom and I have learned lessons from the experiences we've had, because then they're not wasted times, and I don't have a day to waste. Serenity and peace, that's what I search for. It's being able to share part of myself with you today. It's loving my friends and being kind to others. It's doing the best I can today with what I have to work for. It's searching for God's will for my life and me having the power to carry that out. I'm not what I want to be. I'm not what I hope to be. But I thank God, because of Al-Anon, I'm not what I used to be. Thank you.